For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good morning, everyone. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Paul Zengyu, Paul Disco. I'm Taigen Layton. For newcomers, I'm the guide Dharma teacher at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. And Zengyu Paul Disco, who's our guest speaker today, Paul was a direct disciple of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center. And he was a priest ordained by Suzuki Roshi together with my teacher, Tenshin Reb Anderson. Suzuki Roshi sent Paul to Japan to train as a temple carpenter and architect and designer. Paul was in Japan for 5 or 6 years and trained there as a temple architect and also studied with a Japanese Zen teacher. After he returned, he built many buildings at Zen Center, including the Tasahara Zendo and the kitchen and the Founders Hall later. He built the Green Gulch Guest House, and he has built many temples in the United States and in Europe, as well as Japanese-style homes throughout the United States and Europe. He later received Dharma transmission from Tenshin Anderson Roshi. I had the pleasure of serving as Paul's attendant at a practice period at Tasahara in the early 80s, which was a lot of fun. And I also want to mention that Paul shared a lot of his wisdom about, I don't know if you can see this book, Zen Architecture, that Paul, beautiful book that Paul wrote. I don't know if it's visible here, but Paul wrote this book and shared a lot of his wisdom about Zen temple design and Zen architecture in this book. So Paul's been joining us actually for a while now on our Ancient Dragon Zen Gate Zoom talks, and is going to give the talk today. And the title of his talk is very provocative, The Nature of Delusion and Our Life in the Midst of Shared Delusion. So that'll be some of what Paul talks about. And thank you very much, Paul, for coming and giving this talk this morning.
There we go. Thank you, everyone. Taigen and I go back a long ways, and we were not only at Tasahara together, but we also bonded together because we had a similar, radical background as being someone that was active, politically active, before we became active in Buddhism. So we understood each other in many terms, and Zen practice, Tasahara in general, brings many, many different kinds of people together that don't necessarily have a philosophical or a historical background that is compatible. But we have Zazen together, we have the practice together, and that unites us. But our private histories are often quite different. Anyway, as you were told, I've been building Buddhist buildings for now close to 50 years, and when I was sent by Suzuki Roshi to learn to build temples in America, when I got back to the United States, I found out that Americans weren't really interested in traditional temples. They wanted American temples for American Zen. and just doing the chant right now, the opening chant right now struck me as a reminder. The way that you folks do that chant is very different from the one that we first started doing in English way back, you know, what, 30 years ago, 50 years ago now. And it's changed over the years, and everybody sort of, different groups and different people have, oh, no, that really means this, or well, this is a better word for that. Or it's the American way to want to refine and update and put your stamp on things and turn them into something new. So my wishing to do basically Tang Dynasty buildings and Tang Dynasty inspired buildings, which is what I was studying. You know, from the 7th century, I would say one of the highest points of architecture ever achieved. Asia was never big on music, on symphonic music, but their architecture was very much, very, very much like music and very, but for the eye, not the ear. Anyway, I ended up building a few temples, mostly in Europe, traditional temples. But I also ended up building palaces for rich people, which is the, sort of the main bulk of my work, for better or for worse. But my teaching was all based on action, because in Japan, the way that Buddhism is taught is through physical situation. Zazen, of course, the primary, but also just how you do things, how you put your shoes, how you clean. Suzuki Roshi's big teaching, yes, I'd say big teaching, one that he took very seriously and even got a little angry about, which was unusual for him, was the broom. Put the broom with the handle down and the bristles up. And he says that brooms cannot take care of themselves. Brooms are not capable of sitting themselves upright, but we are, and we should always take care of a broom and put it upright. And he would get quite upset, actually, if he found somebody putting a broom upside down or in his way of thinking. And there was many, many things he did that was taught through showing rather than telling. And I followed in that footsteps because most of my teachers were Japanese, and I spent a lot of time with the Japanese teachers and in Japan proper. So, and also being dyslexic, the written word was not something that, not a friend. So a large part of my teaching activity has been through demonstration, through building with attention, building with intent. The motto of my building company was that process is our product. Process is more important than product. So it was how we did things was what I was trying to teach. Not what we did was secondary importance. It was the target, but not how you pulled the bow. Anyway, I have 30 years of teaching that way, and I wrote the book I wrote that Taigen mentioned is all about the Genjo Koan, but I never mentioned the Genjo Koan once in the book, as I recall. I don't think I ever did. Anyway, I mentioned Dogen and I mentioned Suzuki, but just as in passing, as them being influences. But the whole book is based on how to design using the Genjo Koan. But I never said that, and I'm just now becoming around, now that I'm retired and no longer building for, well, I am still doing design work, but anyway, I no longer have a business, I no longer have employees. That you have to do both. That the here in the United States, we're quite involved in the concepts and talking and philosophical viewpoints. where in Asia, they're much more interested in body movement, how you place yourself, where you look, what you think, where your mind is, and less on doctrinal nuances. But anyway, today I would like to talk about not so much doctrinal nuances, but more about a practice in the sense of how we live our everyday life. So Zen doesn't mention it much for some reason. I always wondered why, but I never really knew. But Zen teachers hardly ever talk about the Four Noble Truths. And I think all of you that have had some cursory involvement with Buddhism, as well as long-term practitioners, are well aware of the Four Noble Truths, but basically that life is suffering, and that the cause of suffering is our attachment, and that the way to get out of suffering is to drop clinging. So it's the attachment part. It's the attachment part that I want to talk about today. So what is attachment? What are we attached to? What are our attachments? Well, some of them are very basic, like being attached to breathing, for example. That's sort of understandable. But a lot of them are attached to liking butter rather than olive oil. A lot of them are attached to being attracted to a certain kind of person. A lot of them are attached to thinking that the government should run in a certain kind of way. We have a great deal of built up attachments that we have built up stories around and we cling to and are basically kinds of delusion. and we say in Buddhism that everybody falls into three categories: greed, hate, and delusion. But of course, it's a mixture. We're all a mixture of those, but mostly we hold out in certain camps. But that's not the kind of delusion I'm talking about. That kind of delusion is a personal delusion, thinking that we are bad, or thinking that we are good, or thinking that we are rich or poor, or thinking that we're one thing or the other. We have all these views of who we are that we tell ourselves that we are attached to, and that's, everybody has that. That's part of what this, who our sense of, you know, we're attached to a sense of self, for example. Or in Buddhism, we know that that's an empty attachment, but we are very much attached to a sense of self. But we also have attachments to social attachments. Being group delusions. And this was something that I came across just recently in the last few months, and I thought was so profound that I'm taking this opportunity to share it with you. And some of you already know about it, but a few years back, a man, an Israeli man, wrote a book called Sapien. And what is his name? His name is Yuval Noah Harari. Anyway, he wrote a book about called Sapien, and it's all about the humanoid creatures that inhabited this world, and how we ended up, we Homo sapiens, ended up being on top of the pile, and why we have control of the earth and are so deeply involved in controlling everything. So that's anyway. It's a very well written and very, very easy to read book. I would recommend it to anybody. But, and it's also, for some reason, he's been very popular. I mean, which is a little scary, because he's popular with some very, very powerful people. And he's invited to talk at international meetings of the rich and famous, And as from my with my radical background, I'm always suspicious of anybody that the ruling elite likes. But anyway, he is definitely popular because I hear it because it's so profound, and it's not necessarily judgmental. It's merely observation that humans have a unique quality. Humans have a very unique quality. And in Buddhism, we think of the six realms. There's the heavenly realm. There's the Asura realm, the warring titans. Anyway, it's different people call it different things. Suzuki Roshi used to always say that heaven was a very bad, very dangerous place to be. You didn't really want to go to heaven, because there's a long ways to fall if you fall. Anyway, and the Asuras, I always saw the Asuras as being, the people that are fighting the status quo, fighting injustice, fighting for the underdog, fighting for a deeper understanding of the world. And growing up in a radical family that I did, my heroes were definitely Asuras. They were, Chou En Lai, Paul Robeson, Malcolm X, Langston Hughes. Anyway, there were people that were out there crying out against the injustices of the world. I grew up in a biracial family. That's why so many black people in it. The Asuras, and I've always sort of identified with Asuras, but which is probably not to my benefit, but anyway, I can't, it's a karmic, it's an attachment, it's a delusion that I hold, not with any belief, but with a very sticky residue. Anyway, then there's the human realm, and the human realm is the realm of cause and effect, or the realm of the sense of a self. Humans have a sense that they exist. Humans have developed a sense of self, and it's the realm in which Buddhas appear. Buddhas do not appear in heaven. Heaven is not interested in Buddhas. The Asuras are too busy killing off each other, creating chaos and mayhem in the process, to be interested in Buddhas. But the human realm is the realm in which Buddhas appear. The animal realm is too so caught by their intuitive needs and their intuitive activities for them to be able to look for a Buddha. And of course, the hungry ghosts and the hell realms are people that are just trying to save their ass. They can't possibly think about something like enlightenment. So here we are stuck in this human realm, and this human realm, since we've killed off all the other humanoids, and one way or another, either by breeding them into our gene pool or by purely killing them, here we are being the dominant species on the planet that control everything and are the total power of the moment. And it's a fairly recent thing. I mean, it's been like maybe 10,000 years that we have been the dominant species that's been killing off the Neanderthals and the other subgroups. But it's only been in the last, 500 years, they say, but basically the last 200 years that we have taken charge of the physical world and turned it around and turned it inside out and made it obey our wishes. And how is it that we were so successful? What is it that makes us so successful, according to this author that wrote this book, Sapien, is that we are able, like no other species, We are able to share delusions. So we can have group delusions. We don't just have our personal delusions about us, ourselves, but we can share our delusions. And we can share our delusions. Well, religion, of course, is one of the largest shared delusions. But nationality, nationalism is another shared delusion. And certainly black and white is a shared delusion. Anyway, the ability to have a shared delusion allows us to team up together and go to war and kill off our enemies. It's not just our family, my family against your family. It's all, you know, 300 million of us against the other 300 million or 500 million or 2 billion or whatever. It's a larger shared delusion, which allows us to team up to do things like, you know, blast the top of a mountains and dig up coal. It allows us to do things like develop the atomic bomb. And it's a very powerful force. And how is that? And how do we come to that, point of being? It's through the teachings of our society, and society teaches us, and it's usually done by the people that have more authority in the world, who have more to lose, or more, they're the power elite, basically, are the ones that set that build the delusions. But there's always, you know, Bernie Sanders and his friends were trying to establish a delusion that we could have socialism in America, but he was not as powerful as some of the other groups. But anyway, when this happens in another country, if it happens in Russia, we call it propaganda. When it happens in the United States, we call it advertising. But basically, it's all a kind of brainwashing that we all go through constantly by whatever media we listen to, or whatever books we read, or whatever media that we consume. So we all are constantly bombarded by trying to line us up into agreeing on some particular way of seeing the world. And by and large, it's been quite successful in America and lining us up for a materialist, individualist, materialist kind of way of seeing the world, which is debatable. But it also plays out in things like racism, you know, in the turn of the last century, you know, a little over 100 years ago. There was a great movement in the world of a socialist movement in the world, and there were cries of "Workers of the World Unite!" "Workers of the World Unite!" was the phrase that was being pushed, being propagandized around the world, and it took roots in many many parts of the world. And it became a major rallying cry for large groups of people, especially those who were suffering from the dislocation of the Industrial Revolution. And at that time, also, it was the beginning of the real push for Jim Crow. That's when Jim Crow laws were passed, and it was also when all these statues that they were tearing down now were put up. You know, 120 years ago, all these statues of Confederate generals and people that were white icons of white separatism, and that black people were relegated to a separate category and told and they were taught that they were bad and you shouldn't associate with them and they had to be kept separate because they were bad. But basically, it was just a way of divide and conquer, which is, you know, a way that the ruling class has done for centuries, whether it's in colonialism or just to, I mean, it's, you know, Balponi, what's his name, the Italian philosopher wrote about it. You know, the enemy of my enemy is my ally. So you divide and conquer, and thereby you can keep control of things. So that's been built up, and we've been bombarded with over the last 100 years, our families, our successions about how our group is good and their group is bad. Until now, it's something that's ingrained in our delusional thinking that we are somehow separate individuals, separate kinds of people, that there's good people and bad people, and bad people are generally black and good people are generally white. It's something that the society has pumped for so long, for the last 100 years, that some people actually believe it. Anyway, much to my surprise, this book that I'm talking about, Sapien, who's an Israeli, I assume Jewish, but not necessarily. He has actually a Persian last name. So, but there are of course many Jews in Persia that were in Persia anyway. Were in Iran at that time. It was a large center of Jewish life. Anyway, his conclusion that the only way to escape this quagmire of delusion and this ongoing brainwashing and battleground for people's minds was through meditation. So I felt very heartened that was his conclusion, and that his message is going out worldwide. And I think you see signs of it here and there. There's a program on a New York Public Radio that in the evening that starts out with a period of meditation on the radio, which is hard to imagine, but they do it. Anyway, I think the hallmark of our practice is perceiving things directly. And that is best done through meditation, through zazen. And everything else is sort of secondary to that. It's just so much delusions. I remember one time down at Tassajara, for some reason, Suzuki Roshi was up by the front gate, and I was up there also doing something. I don't know. I was sort of in charge of the physical plant at Tassajara for most of those years, so I took care of a lot of things that were physical in nature, like people breaking down their cars, breaking down at the bottom of the hill, and keeping the fences intact. Anyway, it was a period there at Tassajara in the 60s when we attracted a large number of very, very unusual people that had a vast amount of ideas. They were from outer space, they were from this, they were from that. They I remember there for a long time we had this invasion of people that wore sheets. They just wore white sheets. And we called them the sheets, and they had a story. I don't even know what their story was, but there was dozens of them. And they hung out outside the gate. I don't think we ever let them in. Maybe we did a little bit, I don't know. But anyway, it was not unusual for people at that time, the 60s, with very, very tripped out ideas to show up. And I remember this one time with Suzuki Roshi standing at the gate, and we both, I think me more observed, but I talked to them for a while. I tried to explain to them this was a closed community. We had rules that they could come in under certain circumstances, but they had this and that and everything. And I tried to explain it to them what was going on there, and they went on about whatever they had to say, and they finally they left. And I said to him, I said to Zuki, I said, those people were really deluded. And he says, you have to remember, we're all deluded. So that made a big impression on me. And I've held that in my mind, foremost in my mind, all these years. And I've been happy to share that little piece of good news with you all. Thank you very much. Is there anything anybody would like to say or ask?
So thank you very much, Paul, for that very provocative talk. So we can now have a period for discussion, responses, questions. Anyone who would like to respond or ask Paul some questions, if you're visible, you can raise your hand. For those who are not, you can go to the participants button on the bottom, and there's a way to, at the bottom of the list of participants, you can, there's a button where you can raise your hand and I'll call on people. So anyone who has a question, please feel free. That we have some time now for discussion. So Dave, yes, Fushin, please.
Why not, right? So thank you, Paul, for your talk. So do you believe that we can escape delusion? That's the question.
Well, that's of course the great question. You know, that was the question that Taigen brought up the other day about the wild fox. So that's a question that has been debated for maybe 1,200 years at least, if not more, in the Buddhist world. I would be way too timid to try to say yes or no.
Okay.
Could you maybe say something about the question of escaping delusion? I mean, you suggested that through meditation, we might be able to escape delusion. So that's what was confusing me.
Well, that's certainly the only avenue. That's the avenue that we have available to us to even approach the subject. Whether we achieve escape velocity or not is something that's been debated for many years. And some people think it takes generations, and some people think it's impossible, and some people think that you can do it. But I don't think that it's important. The end result is the process. Like I say, it's the process of doing it that's important. So trying is as good as doing.
Thank you, Paul. Other comments, responses, questions? Please raise your hand or hit the button. Yes, Joanne. Joanne. You have to hit the unmute button.
Uh-oh. I'm muted by the host, it says.
No, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So, I believe through meditation we realize that we are interconnected with every other living thing on the planet. And once we realize that, then we have a different perspective. Is that also a delusion?
Huh. Well, if you hold that view as a delusion, as an attachment, but if you just experience it, it's not.
Ah, interesting. So in these times, there seems to be a lot of things that are hard to sort out, you know, or I find myself seeking truth a great deal and not finding it unless I just go back to my cushion and let the world sort itself out. But I also feel a call to be activist and to call out things that I feel are doing more harm than more good. And so, you know, it's tricky to know if what those things are and to discern. Discernment is part of this whole thing, I think. So, but, you know, we do the best we can with the information that we have and follow our hearts, I think, and the principle of first do no harm. So.
Well, sometimes it takes harm to do good. So don't even rely on that. Sometimes people need a good shaking to wake them up to see what's really happening. So even that, I think generally speaking, do no harm is a nice policy. But I wouldn't even get trapped in that. Sometimes you need to yell and scream.
That can become duality as well, is what you're saying.
Sometimes you need to yell and scream and say harsh things for the good of the person that you're working with.
Okay. Yelling and screaming isn't so much harm, in my opinion. It's maybe to the person who's doing it. I don't know. Things just seem so confusing at times. You know, it's hard to get a purchase on life when things are shifting so much.
Well, best not to look for too many hard answers.
Okay. Thanks for the reassurance.
Douglas, did you have your hands up? You're muted.
Yeah, my hand wasn't up, but I was getting ready to raise it. I wonder, Paul, about how we step outside of those delusive views and propaganda and groupthink. I mean, sometimes some Zen teachers talk a lot about avoiding the deluded thinking by acting more from, let's say, from the hara, from the belly. And certainly that's a tradition also in martial arts. And I was wondering, is that something you learned in studying temple architecture and carpentry in Japan? Do you have any views about that?
I'm not quite sure what your question is, but I can certainly talk to the studying from the belly kind of thing. That permeates all of Asian teaching in Asia, is that the hara is the center, not the brain. So it's all about what comes out of your centeredness, your physical body, rather than what comes out of your thinking mind. And it's something that is extremely hard for us Westerners to get a grasp on. I've been studying it all my life, and I don't feel any closer to having a grasp on it. And certainly when I'm living outside of that environment, it's extremely hard to do, and impossible for me to teach anyway. I think martial artists maybe have a little bit better chance to do it because they have a goal in mind. They hold out a prize, and they can seduce people into practicing that way by holding out the sort of skillful means, by holding out a prize. I never tried that with my students because I was doing it silently, and I was only very, very modestly successful. I mean, I have no idea how successful I was, but anyway, it's a very powerful difference between doing something with your body, and that's what I was alluding to earlier about standing the broom up or not. I mean, it's all the difference. It's extremely different. It's teaching without words rather than teaching with words. But Dogen's great effort was how to teach the wordless teaching with words. Mm-hmm. So that's what koans are about. That's what our teachers are always struggling with, how to express enlightenment that's unexpressible. So there's no answer really. There's no key. There's no to it. It's a moment by moment activity.
Thank you.
Other questions or responses? Raise your hand or hit the button on the participants. Oh, hi, Eileen.
Hi. Paul, thank you so much. The ending of We Are All Deluded was so freeing for me. It's not that I haven't, we've heard this before, but it just popped something open. Oh, I can let go of all this anxiety about trying to do it perfectly, which, try as I may, we all know we're not supposed to do that. But then, right, even that is a structure. It's not, shouldn't try to do that because you can. But just, we're all deluded. It's fine. Now just proceed from there. And it just blasted a little window through my discomfort this morning. So I really need to.
Well, I'm glad I was able to say it in a way in which you were receptive to it. That when Suzuki Roshi said it to me under those circumstances, it was just such a powerful blow for my understanding, because here I was, this person that was practicing meditation and following all the rules and going when the bell rings and so on top of it. And had a clear view of the world and was taking care of things and could make a car run and could make sure the water didn't, I was so on top of everything. And here these people were, they were just totally out to lunch. I mean, they were just completely way gone. And he pointed out that there's no difference between us. We were both dwelling in this land of make-believe. And, It just struck me so deeply that at that time, and I'm very happy that I was able to pass that feeling on.
It enables us to laugh at ourselves too, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely.
So, Ian, you have your hand up. Okay.
Yeah, Paul, I wanted to ask about the differences in temples between the East and the West, and if those differences reflected at all changing religious sensibilities as Zen comes from the East to the West.
Wow, that's a big question. But basically, I have built traditional temples, but I built them in Europe. The Europeans are much more interested in tradition. Americans, they always want the next new thing. They say they want the next new thing, but basically American architecture is stuck in the 30s and 50s modern is sort of, if it's not modern, 50s, if it's not modern, nobody takes it seriously. So it's just where American architecture is located. It's all about economy. It's all about money. How to build as much space as cheaply as possible. It's not how to build the most beautiful building, but how to build the most efficient building. We're caught up in that kind of thinking, and just like the chant at the beginning of the talk, everybody wants to put their two cents in and make it a little bit different. As if that's going to solve some problem somehow. It's just kind of who we are. It's just sort of the American psyche is that we want to put our stamp on things. We want to think that we are in charge of the world and that we can make a difference by coming up with something new and exciting and special. As you can see, I'm not in favor of it, but anyway, that's my take on it. I feel that polishing a tradition, making it deeper and broader and more sophisticated, is a far more noble human act than trying to come up with something new and shiny and bright. But that's purely my own personal delusion that it makes a difference.
Thank you. Other comments, questions, Aishin?
Thanks for a wonderful talk, Paul. It seems like the greatest harm in our country these days is being done by the people who hold the most tightly to their delusions. And it seems like we can't escape delusion, but there are degrees to which we can recognize it and degrees to which we hold tightly to it. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about how we can maybe help ourselves and others to hold less tightly to our delusions.
Well, there was a program that maybe you've heard about it that was done in Uganda, I believe, by a Dutch company. Anyway, because of the tribal conflicts there and the genocide there, there was this antipathy between these two groups, and they were interested. The question was, can you teach anti-racism? Is it possible to combat racism through teaching? Is there a way of making people not be racist? And they did this whole big program. Maybe you've heard about it, where they started a soap opera. They started this dramatic program whereby there was all this, it was interesting. It caught people's attention. Everybody wanted to tune into it. But it was the interplay between the two tribal groups, between the two different groups, and how they integrated and how they got together and how, and it became very popular in the country over a 3 or 4 year period. I think it's still going on now, actually. They set up a social norm where it was sort of socially improper or socially bad to like be discriminatory against the other group. So they made it sort of a social norm to be hospitable to whoever their opposing group was. But then they went around and surveyed people individually. And it turns out that the people individually were just as racist as they ever were against the other group. But they didn't act on it. They acted that because of the social pressure of being harmonious and that being a positive thing, they acted as if they weren't in public. So I think that's the best we can do. I think we can do more and more things where it's coming out now, but as somebody that grew up in a black family, I was taught this at a very early age, but the deck is stacked against black people in this society, but it just totally is. And until we reshuffle the deck and maybe even give them a few aces to start off with, it's going to be that way. But I don't think we're ever going to get rid of, generations of racism in people's hearts. But we can make an even playing field on the social level by passing rules and by passing laws and by giving, balancing the field. If black people had a better chance at education, or if there were black banks that could help them create the personal wealth, or there's lots of things that could be done to even the field, but I don't think from what I've heard from other people is that you can't really stamp out that kind of group delusion. Doesn't go away fast. Maybe it takes generations for it to wear away.
Thanks. That's really thought provoking. You can't necessarily change delusions, but you can like set things up so that people can behave in different ways.
You can act differently. Yeah.
Yeah.
by another set of delusions, by building up another set of delusions. You know, that you have to be, you know, you have to do all these things to be socially acceptable.
I'm surprised that we don't have more TV shows or, you know, some of these other social structures in place to educate people. At least I have not been aware of them.
Well, there are for women anyway. There's a especially overseas, especially in England and Europe, and there's shows that empower women greatly, but it hasn't gotten there for Black people yet.
Other questions, comments? Thank you very much, Paul. Douglas, something else?
No, Ed is the next one, I think.
Again, I think Ed and Jason have raised their hand.
Ed?
Oh, thank you. I believe this. My question is related to what Aishin was discussing, but in your lovely book, Zen Architecture, and I'll read one sentence. You mentioned that the San Man, I think, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Mountain Gate,
yes.
The Mountain Gate, you note that it represents a symbolic transition from one realm to another, and that in a Buddhist temple complex, when you walk through this San Man, you are ascending the mountain, leaving everyday cause and effect behind, both physically and spiritually. My question is the space after this gate physically different from the space before the gate?
Well, no, it's the act of walking through the gate that is you know, Muman, that's the gateless gate. That is the famous gateless gate. So it's a barrier that you pass through that is not a barrier. That there's no barrier there. So this is one of the hallmarks or one of the important teachings of Zen Buddhism in particular is entering this gateless gate, and it means that you're entering a practice realm, that you're making, that you have awakened the way seeking mind, and that you are making an effort to practice.
Thank you.
Paul, following up on that, my sense is that a big part of what Zen priests and Zen teachers do is to create a space that is conducive to practice, to zazen, to, I don't know if it sees through delusions, but at least to...
Change the picture anyway. Yes.
Yeah, to being upright, as Tenshin says. Given your years of practice with creating spaces, can you speak a little bit about space and temple architecture and how that helps us with practice? And I'm thinking about this particularly now that we are in the Zoom world. So I don't know if you want to get to that, but how does temple architecture help us with practice? I guess that's my question.
Well, the most important part of temple architecture is the fence around it, is the wall around it, it's the circle, it's the semicircle, it's the containment. You're setting off the space inside the circle is no different than the space outside the circle, but once you draw a line around it, it becomes different. So I think we all have that experience from a visual artistic point of view, but it applies to architecture as well. And the Zoom thing, I don't know. I find it, I mean, I'm probably as big a Luddite as you're ever going to find. I mean, I just got a cell phone just a couple of years ago, and I, and and I'd only have an iPad. I'd only even have a computer, but it's amazing. I mean, it allows me to be here with you all, you know, which I flew out there once or twice over the last years, but I enjoyed it out there, but take a week out of my life to come and, you know, when I have work and things to do, it's just not really that realistic. And this way I get to be with you all just by dropping in. I don't even have, I don't even have any pants on, you know, I mean, I'm just sitting here talking to you all I don't have to go out of the house. I'm in my late 70s now, so it's not so easy, but it's wonderful. I don't know. It's a whole new realm. I don't know. I don't have any ideas about it, but I kind of like it.
Excuse me, just to follow up. And then I forgot to mention that Paul had come and spoken at our temple in Chicago a while ago. And that was wonderful. And now he's been coming regularly to our Zoom events. And I'm, you know, sort of a Luddite too. I feel like I'm from the last millennium anyway. But the thing about temple architecture and the beautiful buildings you've built, and, you know, there's a way in which, as you say, marking off a space for practice does something. I don't quite understand it, but I spent my first experience of Zen really was going around to temples in Kyoto and Nara and being just blown away by the Zen gardens and also the statues, but just feeling something about that space. There's something about the traditional Zen temples that creates some feeling. I don't have the words for it. You know how to do it. You apprenticed and learned how to create these spaces. And, you know, my sense of being a Zen priest is that what we learn is how to create that space. So we did it in our little storefront temple on Irving Park Road, where we built this, where we created a Zendo in this little space. And Myozan, who I think is here, and others in Hyde Park created a Zendo in this huge Gothic cathedral, which is very challenging in a huge space. And Asian and others have done it outdoors, where we have an outdoor Zendo. There's something about creating a space, and it's, I don't know what it is exactly, but that's part of the heart of our practice, is there's a particular space. So you talked about building a container. And anyway, I want to hear more from you about that. I think Aishin had her hands up. She wanted to add to the question, if you want to, Aishin.
Well, that maybe is a longer discussion, but basically what we call what we do practice. And I think there's a good reason for using that word, because that's what we are doing. We call that, you know, if you're shooting hoops, you're practicing. If you're, you know, if you're whacking golf balls, you're practicing. If you're playing the piano, you're practicing. There's a lot of different ways to practice, but you need something to practice with. You need crutches, practice. That's sort of a negative way of putting it, but practice toys, practice implements, something to practice with. You can sit there and at a table and do the fingering, but it's a lot better if there's piano keys under your fingers, as you're going to practice music, for example. So basically what a temple is setting up practice opportunities. So there's a threshold that you have to step over in a certain way. There's floors that you have to clean. There's cushions that you sit on. There's all these things that you can use to practice with, and that you can get. All practice is setting up a framework in which you do activities and thereby make yourself visible. If you just practice in the void, out in the big void, in the realm, you don't learn anything. But once you set up a criteria, once you set up a target, and you shoot an arrow at the target, then you know, oh, I'm pulling to the left, I'm pulling to the right. You learn something. If you just take arrows and shoot them off into the air, you have no idea about, you have ideas about how hard you can, how far you can pull the bow, but you have no ideas about whether you are prone to go to the left, prone to go to the right, too high, too low. So we need a target. We need a target to shoot at, and that's what, and a temple gives us that opportunity. It also is a focusing. It focuses and since we are these creatures, these animals that like to relate, that are tuned into each other psychically, and like to share understandings. It's very powerful to have other people there doing it with you. I think I was amazed at how much I get from sitting zazen with even on people that are on the screen. I mean, I was just totally amazed by it. I deeply understand how sitting with people in a zendo is so much more powerful than sitting at home by yourself. That I was well aware of, but I was really wonderfully pleased about sitting there with these other people, sitting there also on the screen, and it gave a power and an energy and a good feeling that I really, maybe just because I'm all, most of my zazen experience has been a group practice, but I think being together, a critical mass is, I think, important also.
Thank you, Paul. I see that my old friend Jeff Bickner had his hand up. Welcome, Jeff. You have a comment, question.
Yes, I want to thank Paul for all his wonderful insights today. And I really appreciate them. And all the years I've known Paul, I've never heard him speak and share his dharma. So I really appreciate that. And I wanted to say that I've experienced a lot of his building activity, building a new zendo at Tassajara and the guest house at Green Gulch. And there was always a sense of we were all part of something bigger. You know, it wasn't stagnant. There was activity and there was building and we were expanding. And it was really wonderful. So I want to thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you, Jeff.
And welcome, Jeff. Please come again. Other comments? Aishin, please.
Thanks. I just wanted to add to the discussion about space. I co-lead the camping session annually with Gyoshin Laurel Ross, although we couldn't do it this year because of COVID. And we, you know, camp around a giant tent zendo that's 10 feet by 20 feet. And so we, you know, we have a screen enclosure and we're sitting inside that screen. Well, one year, due to high winds, the tent blew over and was wrecked basically on the second day of Sesshin. And so we didn't really know what to do. We ended up just taking the poles that formed the perimeter of the roof and marking out a 10 foot by 20 foot space for ourselves. And we put our, you know, we set it up just the way it had been with the altar at the front and our zafus and zavatans and chairs along the side. And we had to come up with a couple of things. We agreed where the entrance was because you could just walk in anywhere, but that was completely chaotic. So we agreed where the entrance was, where you took your shoes off, you know, where the altar was, where you bow. And we actually waited in line to walk out of the door. And this really helped us to practice. And you could say that it's all convention or delusion, actually, that we had set this up, because it's not really reality. You can actually walk into that space anywhere you want. But I think there's something there too that you're also saying about needing some conventions in order to help us move beyond conventions, or needing some delusion to help us move beyond delusion, like needing our words and our thoughts to help us move beyond our words and thoughts. I will say that the one downside to this arrangement was that many of us got covered with mosquito bites over the 3 days. And so we agreed that you need a roof and some walls for real.
Well, thank you for that illustration of the gateless gate. I think that's very powerful. I can remember though in Japan that they would keep the windows open and you were supposed to let the mosquitoes suck blood until they fell off and splatted on the ground. So it's some people consider mosquitoes as a practice aid.
So Phyllis and Belinda, either one of you have your hands up, so please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Tigan. And thank you, everybody, for your input and definitely for Paul's talk. It was great. And I also want to echo the Asians' input on building a space. I had the privilege of trying to set up space in unconventional area to support retreats. And I found that your mind, when you set up that space, is all going to how to support the retreaters, how to support the participant who want to sit through the entire day so that they don't have to worry about bumping into furniture. They don't have to worry about where to go to get a glass of water, so that their mind can actually focus on working with itself, so to speak. So setting up space, to me, it's full of compassion, especially for setting up a sendo, setting up a practice space. And therefore, when I walk into a temple, like Taigen said, it do something to me because I can experience all those compassion that goes into it, that put the space together, that take care of the space for me in order for me to work hard. So that is another type of encouragement, another way for me to experience the spirit of everybody's effort. So I really appreciate those space. Thank you.
I would like to add that's very, very, very well put. But also, there's also antiquity too. There's also, if you're going into a space that's been there for 300 years or more, and all of the chanting and all of the zazen energy and all of the incense burning and has seeped into the environment and becomes part of the environment. So a temple that's been practiced in for many years has a certain aura that a new temple maybe wouldn't have, but a new temple is still the importance of having that form, whether it's new or old.
Taigen, I see Eve and Nyozan with raised hands.
Does Eve want to go first, or?
I think maybe Taigen got knocked out of the room, so.
I got cut off. Thank you, David. Eve up first?
I think so.
Go ahead, Eve.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about delusion. So I've been part and physical space and Zoom space. I've been participating in some online conferences these past couple of days with Interplay people, which is a set of forms for storytelling and movement and solo and group improvisation. And they've actually been really good at trying to figure out how to do stuff online and create human connections online, and they've also been engaged in anti-racism exercises and trying to figure out what to do in that arena. I'm a social scientist, and my language is like, you know, delusion translates into social construction, and that race and class are both socially constructed, but that doesn't mean they're not real and that they don't have real consequences. But it means if you're trying to, and I also feel like some, some delusions have better consequences than others. And then part of the challenge is to figure out, what delusions or conventions that we do want to support. In the middle of all that, so one of the people came up with this exercise, because we do this following and leading stuff. So some people move, like person A moves, and then person B follows and copies the movement or mirrors the movement. And then you can switch and B leads and A follows, and then you can do it so that you kind of drop who's leading and who's following, and then you reflect on how that feels. But so anyways, one person in the group came up with this exercise of, she was doing what she called queering the instructions for leading and following. So she said, well, somebody should lead, person A leads, and then person B should exuberantly not follow. In other words, you try to do something that you feel like is the opposite of what the person who's leading is doing. And, it occurred to me that it's like, it's almost set up like a koan, because then after a while you realize that in going in strong opposition to what the other person's doing, you're still being led by what the other person's doing. And I think that, that exercises like that do something to help you see through delusion and maybe decide what delusions you want to support.
I also would say that it's very important to understand which delusions you have.
Yeah.
To Katagiri Roshi, for years, he would say, settle the self on the self, which I had a little difficulty with at the beginning. He had a number of English things that were hard to comprehend. Like, he talked about frickle. He talked about frickle a lot. I mean, it took us a long time to understand that he meant fickle. But anyway, but settle the self on the self. I think that's a hallmark for us all, is to make friends with ourselves, to say, oh, I have these delusions. This is really who I am. I have, these. Anyway, to be clear with yourself about who you really are, and not make up stories about who you are, is a large part of how our practice works. And until we become friends with ourselves, it's hard to make any forward progress. We need to be careful not to think of the Zazen practice but as therapy, which it is definitely is not therapy. But on the other hand, if we can come to terms with ourselves being who we are, there's a chance for some transformation going on.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, like, noticing what's happening with your physical being is part of that?
Sure. I think that's, I think you need to be aware of everything. This whole new trend now that's sort of taking over in the larger part of the culture called mindfulness practice, I think it's somewhat limited in terms of Buddhist practice, but it's definitely a step forward, definitely a something positive to get involved in. To not only notice the world around you, but to notice yourself. That that third cup of coffee, or that you push the snooze button twice, or that whatever little traits that you have that that uh, that 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 determine who you are.
Yeah, and how you're responding to other people.
And how you respond to other people too, of course, yes.
So, Nyozan, maybe we'll close with your comments and response and discussion.
Well, I wish we had a better comment or response to close with. I just wanted to note, I just want several years ago, Paul, you sold copies of your book, and I have a copy which I've looked at many, many times. I mean, I was sort of treating it as a beautiful picture book, essentially. And then a few weeks back, you said that it was kind of written as a commentary on Genjo Koan, which propelled me to read it. And I just really, well, I've got 10 pages left. But I really, really enjoyed it and want to recommend it to anybody. So that's a comment. But one of the things that you mentioned a couple of times in passing in that book, which I was not aware of, was the way that the smoke in a building with a traditional thatched roof became an important part of sustaining the building, sustaining the roof, because of the preservative qualities of the residue and so on and so forth. So I don't even know if I have enough of a question to ask a question of, but, you know, I do wonder when I think about getting back into the our spaces, our Zen spaces or not, any spaces or not, and the possibility of being on Zoom for a long time is, where's the smoke going to come from? I mean, how is it going to be? I don't know. I can't even ask it better. I just wonder if you have a comment.
Well, I think that's a great question, but I think I don't know the answer. I have no idea about the answer because the Zoom thing is so new and so it's so different from what we're used to doing. It's very, in some ways, it's very intimate. I mean, there's a picture of you right there, and it's just you and me staring at each other as far as I'm concerned. And I would never probably get in your face like that if I was in a big room. You know, you were sitting across the room somewhere. So in some ways, it's very intimate. In some ways, it's very smoky. And in some ways, it's very distant. I just don't know. I think we have to just go into the future and see what comes up and be aware of what our needs are and see what areas need to be worked on. I really don't know. This is a whole new thing as far as I'm concerned. I have no particular ideas about it, but it does for me anyway. It works, much to my surprise. But anyway, thank you very much for your comments, and thank you all for indulging me in my little tirades about how I feel about things, and thank you very much.